To the Oros Rose Watch podcast, I'm your host and producer, Nick Patel, a songwriter, publisher, and music professional. Alongside me have David Lowry and Chris Castle. David Lowry is a platinum-selling songwriter and performer for the bands Cracker and Kemper Van Beethoven. He currently lectures music business students at the University of Georgia and is an ongoing artist rights activist. Chris Castle is a music lawyer in Austin, Texas, where he represents artists and music tech companies and works on public policy issues for artist rights. So I think for this week is finally time to talk about the MLC, the Mechanical Licensing Collective. And before I get too far into it, give you guys a brief history about streaming and the mechanical royalty. Streaming services pay three separate royalties, so a performance royalty paid to the PRO, who pays the songwriter and the publisher simultaneously. You have the sound recording paid to the record label, who trickles it down what's payable to the artist, and the streaming mechanical, which is paid to the publisher, who then pays the songwriter. And today we'll be specifically focusing on the streaming mechanical. Before the MLC was established in January of 2021, streaming services made deals with publishers in order to license their songs on the streaming platform. The process is usually reaching out to publishers individually, of course, striking licenses with Warner Chappell, Sony Music Publishing, and Universal Music Publishing covers a lot of the industry. However, companies like Spotify still need to issue licenses to the independents. We've seen in recent years class action lawsuits against Spotify for not paying independent songwriters their mechanical royalties. One of those class actions was spearheaded by our own David Lowry. Spotify's counter-argument was that they had no way to know who owned the song to pay out the mechanicals, and so they were just sitting and not being paid out. Inevitably, Spotify had to pay millions to settle this lawsuit. The Music Monetization Act simplified the process for getting a license for streaming services, which set up a portal for songwriters, i.e. to establish a governing entity that would facilitate the transactions of streaming mechanicals, and that entity was then going to be the MLC. And what is the MLC? The MLC is the Music Licensing Collective. It's a nonprofit organization designed by the U.S. Copyright Office and took effect in January of 2021. What it basically does is that it administers blanket mechanical licenses to eligible streaming and download services in the United States. So the MLC will then collect the royalties due under the licenses from the DSPs to pay songwriters, composers, lyricists, and music publishers. In the simplest terms, it acts like a PRO, but just administers mechanical licenses instead of public performance licenses. Streaming services are for the MLC because it possibly covers them from any potential lawsuits. If a songwriter doesn't get paid, well, that songwriter didn't sign up for the MLC, which is why they didn't get paid, which means it's their responsibility, not the DSPs. Registering with the MLC has become a standard process for songwriters establishing their claim, much like it is registering for a PRO. And also for today, we will have Stephen Carlisle back with us. We did have Stephen Carlisle earlier in the series to talk about record contracts. He is back because he has had some experience dealing with the MLC in his time as a entertainment lawyer. And to give another brief, quick introduction to him, he was the first copyright officer of Nova Southern University and has 26 years of private practice as an attorney. He's also a two-time chair of the bar, specifically in the arts and sports sections. And he writes a lot of articles for Nova Southern about current issues and copyrights. So as I said last time, his most recent post about who owns Iron Man, Spider-Man, and Daredevil, I'm going to bring that up with him this time, just briefly, because I think that's very interesting, but we're not going to go too far deep into it. But let's go ahead and jump onto the Zoom call, and we'll talk to David and Stephen. So Stephen, welcome back to the podcast. I'm glad you enjoyed it enough the first time to come back on the second time. The Marvel article that you have, Who Owns Iron Man, Spider-Man, and Daredevil, I find that very intriguing as someone who's a Marvel fan. I know we could probably talk about that for another couple of hours beyond this. But I just wanted to say that it seems really cool, and I enjoyed the article.
I had a copy of Iron Man 1. Cost me 12 cents.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's worth about $800 today.
Wow. You know what's funny about this comic book stuff? I'll just go inside. A guy was our attorney for a long time in Camper Van Beethoven, and Cracker was actually like one of our roommates, right? And he was going to law school and working another job, and he started just buying comic books, right? Like, why are you buying comic? He was never seen him read a comic book before. He's like, oh, I think this is going to be my investment, right? And over the years, anyway, he basically collected like just brand new copies of comic books, filed them away in storage, and now he's like sitting on some huge fortune in these comic books and stuff like that. So it's just funny. Anyway, sorry, that doesn't need to go in the podcast, but there must be something about attorneys and getting those number one first issues of comic books, maybe,
Well, this
perhaps.
is a bit of an aside because for when I first started reading Marvel comic books, Iron Man and Captain America shared a comic book. So you would get half a story. And when they finally decided to give both Captain America and Iron Man their own monthly issues, Captain America took over the numbers from the ones that they shared, and Iron Man started all over again at number one. So Cap took on like issue 100, and Iron Man took on issue one. And so that's how that came out.
Well, Stephen, just kind of jump straight into it. I read your article about the MLC. Seems to be a lot of data issues with it. Some examples you mentioned are that anyone can claim a song, certain songs appear randomly, certain songs can't be established, blank royalty statements, and in order to get these issues resolved, it requires weeks of time. So to start, could you go into depth about some of the issues that you faced?
Well, yeah, there are a bunch of problems there. And the primary problem is that the MLC is really depending upon all the songwriters to sort of self-report. But if you've got a publisher, they're going to report for you. If you're going to be affiliated with the Harry Fox Agency, they will also report for you. But the problem with the Harry Fox Agency, as I discovered, there's errors in their database. For my particular client, he was always self-published, never with a major publisher, never with the Harry Fox Agency. So I knew going in that, I would have the best handle on whatever the conflicts were. So I had to, in effect, self-report all 56 songs that were in the client's catalog. And part of the problem begins with the fact that a lot of songs have the same title. I mean, you'd be surprised how many songs there are called I Love You, right? So you have to give them more information so they can get your song matched with people who are streaming it. And that took some time to do. But the main thing that I discovered was when I went in to register my client's songs, was that somebody had already claimed them. And claimed 100% administration rights. And I've been representing the same client for 30 years. And I knew that that was not possible because I'd been doing the attorney work. I've been sending out licenses all over the world. We've got sub-publishers in Germany and in France and in Italy and in England and in South America and Japan. So I had never heard these people or who claimed to be representing my client's catalog in all the 30 years that I've been representing the catalog. So that was a bit of a shock. And they had this sort of interloper, as if you will, had gone in and claimed 100% administrative shares of all of my client's songs. And I just knew from experience that that was absolutely, positively not possible. And the one thing good that I will say about the Mechanical Licensing Collective is they have a phone number that they actually answer. I mean, if try getting it out of, say Comcast or your wireless provider, right? So if you're interested, let me see. I have it someplace here and I can give it to you. It's they're all in Nashville. And their phone number is 615-488-3653. Like I said, they do answer their own phone. and they try to be helpful. But this was a major stumbling block, because then I had to go back in and sort of reinvent the wheel. So I had to go to ASCAP, pull off what they call the T number, which is the title number from ASCAP, and individually catalog all of those songs. And in addition, I went into Sound Exchange to get the ISRC? I forget, whatever.
It's the ISRC, yeah.
The ISRC for each song, and, you know, and then make a whole list to send off to them, right? And much to my surprise, one song had 77 covers, mostly in Japan. You know, it's sort of very interesting that way. The good news was that the interloper backed off immediately and released the claims to all of the songs. And, you know, that was, you know, a great relief to me, because I was thinking there might be a long, hard battle for this. But honestly, you know, what I think I told them, and I've told them on a number of occasions, it's like, you know, these sort of exclusive agreements have to be supported by contracts. So just show me the contract. And I knew that the contract didn't exist, because I had never seen it before, right? So that was one of the problems. You know, I don't want to necessarily throw a lot of shade their way, but this is a monstrous undertaking. But the part of the problem is that they're depending upon the songwriters themselves to self-report all the information that's going into their database. And that is a very, very large undertaking, like I said. Some of the other problems that I had, there were songs in my client's catalog that didn't belong there. They had been attributed to him because he used to play them in his shows, but they were written by other people. But fortunately, I was able to, you know, talk to those people, because we're, you know, in contact with each other. He goes, no, that's mine. And so, you know, how did a song that didn't belong to my client get into my client's catalog? I don't have any idea about that. And then there's the problem of shares. This particular client gets a lot of samples. We do a lot of samples. There's one song in particular, I think it's probably been sampled or interpolated 20 times. And you know, negotiate these song splits, and, you know, not everybody has a clear recollection on what the song splits are. So the problem that I encountered was I was trying to register my client share to a very, very popular song. As a matter of fact, it was a number one rap hit. And it told me that it couldn't process my request, because with my claim coming in, that the shares now totaled more than 100%, which I knew couldn't be the case. And I knew exactly what the split was, because I had negotiated it when we did the license. So again, we go back to the MLC, we get somebody on the phone, and I say, what do I do about this? And they went back in, and somebody ultimately admitted that, oops, we had overclaimed the song. I was able to go in and put the client's claim in to be corrected. The other sort of strange problem that I had was a song that should have been in my client's catalog, but wasn't, because a major music publisher was claiming 100% of the copyright. And, you know, as with a lot of things, I have a copyright office report on all the songs attributed to my client, because he's deceased. So one of the first things that I did was I had the copyright office run a report on every single registration that he had. And my client's name is on the registration as a co-author. And so again, since he was always self-published, I'm saying, how can this possibly be that my client doesn't have an interest in this song when he's listed on the copyright as an author? And so I again had to make this formal demand letter going through chapter and verse about exactly how this was. And eventually the publisher again relented and said, yes, this is correct. You know, your client doesn't indeed have a share of this song. So
can I ask you something really quick right there? How do you know the counterparty? Does the MLC put you with the other party, the party?
No, it was in the song listing.
So then you have to contact
was claiming 100% of the song. And of course, you know, I won't mention any names, but you know, you would all recognize who the major publisher is. So right. When you go into the song record, it will tell you who the claimants are and what is the percentage that they are claiming.
Okay, so Steve, one thing I noticed, I'm not going to interrupt you other than this, is when I went in, I had that issue with one song, at least one song, and it didn't actually give me any contact information for the other. I mean, it gave me like a physical address, but there was no email or no phone number. And it took a while to track that down, actually. Mm-hmm. But so for major publisher, you have a contact number and a contact email.
Yeah.
Not just in your own Rolodex.
They don't give me an actual contact number. The way that it worked with was it was sort of said, you know, writing a demand letter, and I sent it to the MLC. And I look, they're claiming this. The record shows this. Here's the registration number. Here's a copy of the printout from the Copyright Office showing that my client is in fact an author of this particular musical composition. And I sent it to them. They got in contact with the publisher and the publisher relented.
That's what I was curious about. Excellent. Thank you.
So for me, I have registered my own works through the MLC. And seeing that process, so is it as easy as another publisher just grabbing ISWCs and ISRCs and then just registering it as their own and that they claim it? Is it that simple?
I don't know for a fact, but it certainly was very curious that the same publisher out of New York City claimed 100% administration rights over every single one of my client's songs. And that is very strange to me how that possibly could occur. And you'd have to ask the MLC how that happens. But I suppose at this point, they're just sort of trusting everybody to be good, you know, good scouts and only claim what they have. And I'm sure David will say that the music industry is not always populated with good scouts.
Yeah, well, the Hunter S. Thompson quote comes to mind. It's a long plastic hallway. A shallow money trench where pimps and thieves run free, where good men die like dogs. And there's also a negative side. So I had something similar happen, but not with the MLC yet. But I had something on Sound Exchange where somebody just kind of claimed a number of records, because I have my own label too. And generally it's, stuff tends to be licensed out, you know, 10-year stretches to other people. But every once in a while, there'll be something that I have. And in Sound Exchange, it should be coming to my label and stuff like that. And I went in there and I noticed it's like, I've never heard of this label that's claiming my works. And it turned out, I don't know who they were. It felt like kind of was going to be a long process to pursue, but essentially somebody just essentially signed up with a digital distributor, put an album in they found that probably wasn't, it was a minor album. So I don't know if I had ever checked it out on Sound Exchange and claimed it properly, but somehow through a distributor, they were claiming my Sound Exchange money. And I got it corrected, but I got the feeling when I started looking up other things that this label had claimed that it literally was a scam. Somebody had figured out there's like, oh, there's a lot of albums out there. They're, you know, they're getting maybe, you know, $40, $50 a quarter, maybe not even that much, you know, like, you know, $20 a quarter a year or something like that, and had figured out how to just claim these and stick these in. And that's what it looked like to me. It was just literally a criminal racket. So I'm not saying that, I'm not implying that that's what your case was, but I have seen things that look like criminal rackets to me.
Yeah, it's possible because when I eventually got the claim settled on the song that should have been in the catalog, but was not, these same people showed up claiming it for themselves on behalf of ASCAP. And I had to go back in and said, no, these people have absolutely no rights to this. And they apparently got ASCAP got in touch with them and they said, oh, no, we don't have that. But I'm thinking, how did this happen in the first place? Somebody had to do something. Somebody had to tell somebody something or make some kind of filing for this to happen. And, I don't quite know why.
So, Stephen, let me also ask you this. I know that MLC is pulling from the HFA database, Harry Fox Agency, and I know from my time working with Davis Catalog a couple of years ago that there were discrepancies and splits and publishing. Has that played a key role into these issues with the MLC?
I haven't. My particular client generally was a solo writer, didn't collaborate all that much. The only time that you get song split questions today is, again, in the samples, because they want to give you a percentage of the song here and a percentage of the song there. And, it's usually just down to subject to a negotiation. But, since I'm the attorney and I'm part of the negotiation, I know what the song splits are with a reasonable amount of certainty. So,
but I think Nick's asking, did stuff, because some of the database was originally populated with the HFA database. Did you see anything that came from the HFA database that was not correct?
I don't know, because I didn't see the HFA database feed.
Okay.
Since we had never been associated with the HFA, that was sort of an easy call that, whatever we said was going to be, the correct amount and would have not gone through the HFA at all, which, when we were initially, having problems with Spotify, that was, one of the things that I pointed out to them, saying, we're not affiliated with anybody. So you had to come to us, and we're not that hard to find,
Yeah. And David, do you have any experience as a songwriter with MLC, any issues or anything like that? Apart from the HFA thing that I mentioned earlier.
Well, I think mine has been sort of Steve had an issue with his client where, just somebody was claiming all of his works. My problems with the MLC database, and they're still actually outstanding. I've been working through it based on the number of streams. I've started with the songs with the most streams and are working my way down. And there's not a lot of motivation to work on the ones that are lower down because they get so few streams. But this is what happened to me. Because I did associate with HFA actually after the lawsuit and before the MLC came up, what they put into the database oftentimes only had me as the writer and 100%, right? I'm not sure where that comes from. It came from them. It wouldn't come from me, right? So when I first looked at the MLC database, it just had me on a lot of songs at 100%, right? Even though we submitted a CWR submission and stuff like that, it didn't overwrite everything. It didn't overwrite everything. And so I've kind of been going through that. But here's one of the interesting things. Stephen might find this interesting too, is that some of those songs that were 100%, all I can do is lower my share downward, right? But I can't assign any of my co-writer shares because they're not published by me, right? They have no way to do it. There is absolutely no way to do it. And so that relies on a lot of my co-writers. I've been fairly generous with my songwriting over the years, which may or may not have been a good thing, but I always just like, hey, we made this up at a rehearsal, so everybody gets a share, right? And kind of whoever's in the room philosophy. But plenty of songs I wrote by myself or with my one of my key partners or something like that. So there's quite a number of co-writers over the years that don't normally have song publishing, right? Aside from co-writes they did with me or occasionally somebody else. So these are more or less unsophisticated songwriters, often not, you know, their primary thing might be a session drummer, or they might be a session keyboard player or a backing vocalist or something like that. And they're not always used to getting songwriting and managing a publishing catalog. So essentially those co-writers, their shares, even though I've contacted them, it's like an overwhelming thing to them. Their shares are unclaimed, right? So they're not, unless they register with the MLC, it's eventually just going to go into the unmatched and just get sucked up by the other writers that do publish that. So that's another problem. And then there's the curious case where, just frankly, I will fix a song and then it gets unfixed somehow. I don't know how. And so I should have actually looked this week, but I haven't, see, I haven't really looked since probably at the beginning of the semester. I was looking at what the shares look like, and there's stuff I need to work on. But I know that there are tracks that I sorted it out and then somehow it reverted to some previous record. And so my catalog, as sophisticated as I am, it's actually fairly messed up. And one of the key things is, one of the key things that happens is that I will go back to being 100% on a song when I try to like get the other writers, you know, credited on it, whatever. Even if like, you know, now my thinking on it is like, maybe I should leave it 100% and I'll just start accounting to my writers, but I didn't really sign up for that, you know, right?
Now that happened to me where a couple of times correcting something in the MLC database didn't take for whatever reason. And maybe because I didn't pick the next button or the finish button or the whatever button that records it in there. But I recall one time actually having to go in and delete myself as an administrator, only to put myself as an administrator back in so I could input the correct amount of shares. So that's probably just an interface problem that their IT people have to work with. But you know, on the bright side, the client is very happy to get paid monthly and by direct deposit. I, you know, instead of waiting, you know, every 3 months plus a 90-day accounting period to get it paid on a mechanical from something out of a record company, you know, I'm sure they're appreciating the fact that they get paid monthly. And like I said, I set it up so they get paid by direct deposit. I wouldn't say that their royalty statements are a picture of clarity, but I've never seen a record company royalty statement either that was the picture of clarity. So, you know, it would always be like special project RU5682, $47, right? And it's like, okay, what's that? What did that go to, guys?
Exactly. Yeah. I noticed one time on a royalty statement, I was like, huh, like a song was missing, like on a record company royalty statement, a song was missing. And I pulled on that thread. And eventually I was like, wow, I've been missing this for a long time, right? And it was one of those things where, you know, you point it out to the royalty department, it works its way up the chain. And then somebody finally calls you, goes, we don't want to have to go back all those years. How does $50,000 sound, you know, or that kind of thing like that, or like 25, that like a big number, you know, and because it's a lot of work to unwind this stuff, but yeah. And it was kind of dumb on my part. I missed it. So anyway, yeah.
Well, there
it happens everywhere. The best, well, that's what I'm trying to say is like, even when you're trying to do this right, it's extraordinarily difficult and you miss stuff, right?
Well, they miss it too. And, you know, obviously I'm not going to name the name of the group or the name of the record company, but I once represented a member of a very, very famous rock band who had excellent management, and they were engaged in the audit of their record company. And when they got done with the audit, it turns out that the record company had overpaid them. This is how complicated This is how utterly complicated the royalty provisions that are baked into these contracts are, that even the record company doesn't understand them. And so they said, thank you very much. And they didn't say anything, which is probably why you see in some record contracts that if you do an audit of the record company, you have to share the results of the audit with the record company, because they probably figured out in some cases they've been overpaying the artist. That doesn't happen very often, but I at least know of at least one case where it certainly did happen.
Yeah. And for me, working with record contracts on the label side, legal jargon can be very convoluted, and especially for people who don't know what all these terms mean, it definitely can be tough in certain situations.
Well, and plus there, you know, you hear the devil's in the details. I always say that the devil was in the definitions, and what the royalty rate that you get on page 4 is altered by something on page 44. And my favorite example was that there was a discount in this particular contract for what they called audiophile recordings, where you received a reduced rate on any record that was put out as an audiophile record. Well, then you have to flip the definitions and find out what the definition of an audiophile recording is. And buried in that definition was this little gem: all product made for digital playback is an audiophile recording.
So CDs.
Which means that every single CD that goes out the door is considered an audiophile recording and gets a reduced royalty rate. So unless you had earmarked that or flagged it or, you know, remembered it, you know, would have blown right by you.
Well, yes. These are, the devil is in the details. I remember actually going, let's just tell us a few war stories here. I think we need these sometimes on the podcast, but, my band, Camper Van Beethoven, went to Europe and took tour support. And then the band broke up before we completed the tour, right? We got back home and I was back at home and I was sort of used to getting my mechanical royalties through Bug Music at the time on a certain date. And I lived down the street from Bug Music at the time. So I would sometimes walk over and just pick up my check. So I walked over and they had a statement for me, which was $0. And I was super confused by this. And it turned out that in my recording contract, that the tour, so if we didn't finish a tour, the tour support was cross-collateralizable against mechanical royalties.
David, right? Cross-collateralize your mechanical royalty.
But it was, I didn't read the contract. It was a regular attorney read the contract and somehow they didn't see that. Obviously they weren't our attorney that much longer. And maybe the first earlier story I told you might tell you about some of my representation over the years. But it was not cross-collateralization except in this tour support agreement, which I assume the attorney had looked at. And yes, so.
Well, this didn't exactly happen to me, but I learned a lot from it. An attorney told me about going to New York to negotiate a contract for a very big Latin act from Miami. And he was sitting in the lobby and sort of over the shoulder of the secretary, he could see her putting together the contract, this clause from here, this clause from here, this clause from here, blah, 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 cut and paste, print out. And of course, once he gets into the room with the record executive, he pushes the paper toward him and says, this is our standard contract, right? And he said, it was nothing of the sort. It had been pulled over from about 56 different sources and was, of course, not the standard contract. Every contract is different. And, it was a very helpful lesson to learn very early on in my career. So,
yep. Well, me too. That was a very helpful lesson for me to learn early in my career, 4 years into my career, I guess. But
let's bring this back to them. We'll see. I know we went on a little bit of a tangent on record contracts. And we did do a whole episode on it. But Stephen, are there any possible solutions you think for them? We'll see in terms of these data issues occurring? I mean, is it just a issue of refining their data? Do you have any sort of insight into that?
You know, I don't, and there's nothing that I, as an artist attorney, can really do about it. I know personally some of the people who are at the top echelons of the MLC, and before I published my blog post, I said, I've got some issues, and before I go and publish this blog post, I want to touch base with you and talk to you about them so you're not blindsided by them. And they got on the phone with me and I talked about all of these issues so they didn't get blindsided by them. And they were saying, actually to me, says, you're one of our most helpful people because you're on top of this and you're making us aware of these things that we need to take care of. You know, they said, very few people are as involved and as engaged as you are being right now. I said, okay, well, that's kind of a surprise to me, but I think that they're aware of it. But actually getting back to David's story, there's a wonderful saying that the difference between an experience and education is when you read the contract, experience is what you get when you don't read the contract.
Exactly. That's a great quote. I love that. I'm gonna have to quote that sometime for you in class. I'm gonna quote you in class. So cool. Well, Nick, I would say on that, it seems that I think what you should be able to do is you should be able to be like a vetted contributor to the database. Like I'm a vetted, this is my theory on this. I could be like a vetted, you know, like they check my ID, they know who I am or whatever like that, kind of like the stuff you go through for Sound Exchange, right? That kind of stuff. And then I can say, I can actually tentatively enter in like my co-writers and their publishing and their contract information. Now, maybe it's not firm, right? It's in there, maybe they're not paid. And maybe they can then send a notice to the email address or something or phone number that I, or, you know, physical address to those co-writers and say, hey, if you can just prove that you're this person and log in here and affirm these splits. Now, obviously there's potential for abuse there. And that's why I say you don't want to give it to everybody that has an MLC account. But I think there should be some kind of like super user or something like that, that they vet and they let in and maybe even indemnify the MLC. Cause I see that's where there's a lot of unclaimed and unmatched stuff that's just coming out of my catalog is because I can't assign the co-writers. I'm sure there's a million ways to exploit that, but something like that I would like to see happen. And then the other thing is, you know, it'd be interesting for them. I would like to see them run some sort of big data stuff where, I don't know, where they just sort of, this is way of doing a sort of random sampling to figure out what's going on with your data, where you don't even have to do like 10 or 15% of it. What you do is like you do small samples. I'm a math geek, by the way, I was a mathematician. So you do very small samples, but repeatedly across the catalog. I like to see them do that and then be able to compare those to like BMI and ASCAP and just issue a report so that everybody can see what's not matched. And sort of the problems that are happening and how they're occurring. Because I think that's what we need to do is we need to have more, you know, essentially transparency here so people are aware that there's problems. And then maybe from that, we can move towards, you know, figuring out some protocol for getting this stuff right. I mean, I was one of the people that when the MLC was being proposed, I was saying, just hand it to the PROs. Or allow the PROs to be service providers for this. I know there's some complications because mechanicals aren't always split the same way performance royalties are. I think you have that with scores and stuff like that. You might know Steven better. But there's just a number of things I think we that we could do. I don't have a specific solution, but I have a number of little things like that that I'd like to see happen. I think my big idea though is to just have some sort of transparency report issued and go and say, this is what we've matched so far. This is what we haven't matched. These are our problems. And I'd like to see that get out there.
Yeah, I was also thinking about a verification sort of tool when you register your songs. I know that you can input a copyright registration number, but it's not required. So I can register my songs without putting one in there. I'm not sure, you know, how it would work if they wanted to try and make that required or something like that. But I think any sort of extra verification, identity verification or composition verification would be a way forward, perhaps.
Well, that might be, I guess, their initial problem is that in trying to induce songwriters to get as many songs into the database as possible, they made it easy, perhaps overly easy. I got a name, I got a song, here, I'm registering it, right? But certainly when I was doing my client's catalog, I put, and this is part of their advice, as much information as I possibly could get, right? The T number from ASCAP, the ISRC number from Sound Exchange, the copyright registration number, which as I indicated, since I had a copyright report, I had in hand for every single one of them. And, you know, in going to Sound Exchange, you know, I said that I was surprised at how many of their cover versions there were that I didn't know about. But of course, these come from the foreign sub-publishers who license these things and I never see them. But, you know, enlisting every single recording listed on the Sound Exchange database in there, the more that you can do, the better it is for you. But like I said, there is there are so many songs that have the same title. And, you know, you can't just give a name, a composer, and a title and expect that to be, you know, the long and the short of the registration. And perhaps they need to get a little bit more stringent on the registration because these tools are available to them. And you can go and get these numbers. And, you know, certainly it was very time consuming for me to do it, but at least the client is confident that it was done correctly. So. Well, I would say that there's one or two more quotes I might throw out. And one of them is from a fairly notorious record guy by the name of Morris Levy, who is just terrible. But one of the things he said was that, you know, copyrights, they pay pennies, nickels, pennies, but it adds up to good money. And it never talks back to you. A copyright never has a sick day. And it doesn't come to work because it had a fight with its boyfriend, right? So that's one of those things. The copyright's a great thing to have because all it does is go out there and work for you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Artists' Rights to Watch. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, you can add us on Twitter at Artists' Rights or on Facebook at Artists' Rights Watch, or you can check out our website at artistsrightswatch.com. If you missed that or you want more information on this episode, please check out the show notes for further research. We will catch you again next time where we watch for Artists' Rights. Cheers.